You and I back together again for a busy show on Tuesday, November 9th, 2021 for Connecticut. Today we brought you Governor Ned Lamont's announcement of his reelection campaign, courtesy of the fine folks at CTN, that's ct-n.com online, or CTN on your TV provider. I also had some thoughts on rumors that the Biden White House might shut down a key pipeline affecting Canada. Are they crazy or what? And Southern Connecticut State University biology professor Sarah Crawford returned to the show to chat about a rumored COVID-19 pill and the latest on those booster shots. Governor Ned Lamont at an event earlier today, late this morning, that was pushing teacher hiring initiatives for better diversity with teachers. He was alongside 5th District Democratic Congresswoman Johanna Hayes. And he was asked about, well, you know, you filed the paperwork yesterday. Are you running? And if you are, when can we have a formal announcement or just verification that you are running? He was asked that in a couple of different ways. So he talked about the official fact that, yes, he is running. And he was asked, well, why should the people reelect you?
Yeah, because I think the state made extraordinary progress over the last 3 years. We had moving vans leaving the state, businesses leaving the state, people being a little bit down on the state. And I think 3 years later, the moving vans have turned around. Businesses are coming back to the state. We got our fiscal house in order. I think that's all important. Along the way, I think we managed our way through COVID, which is not over. As I suggested, the numbers have spiked up, so we need a little leadership there. And I want to build on what we're doing to get this state moving again. People confident in this state, believing this is a place they want to be.
What is left undone that, you know, you haven't been able to tick off in the first 4 years?
Well, I think we're getting billions of dollars thanks to Johanna Hayes and our federal partners. I think you want somebody with a strong executive background and knows how to put that money to work in the most productive way possible. No waste, and we make a difference out of this extraordinary time. So that's everything from daycare to roads and bridges and rail. What a difference this state could be in the next 4 years.
We could run a platform of universal pre-K?
I think the federal government's making that available for us for at least the next 6 years. Hurry up, Johanna, would you?
Well, speaking of that federal aid, I mean, that's why you were able to adopt a budget that, you relied on what? About $2 billion plus on federal aid. So what happens when that money's not there? How can you keep on counting?
Our budget was balanced this year without that federal aid. As you know, we did end up with a surplus, paid down about $1.6 billion of the pension for the first time in the history of the state. And right now we have to manage through, take advantage of the infrastructure, the daycare, the child care money that we've got to put that to good purpose. We're going to see, Paul, what are the programs that work? I've told every one of my commissioners, show me what works. The President of the United States says, show me what works. So at the end of year two or year three, when I have to go back to Congress or I have to go back to the legislature, the President says, if I have to go back to Congress, we can get this re-upped if we can demonstrate that it's making a real difference in people's lives.
Have you seen anything on the consensus revenue projections that will be coming out this week?
I think certainly for this fiscal year, very positive.
Well, that's my point. You know, when you're relying on this federal money, and there's no federal money. I mean, last year during the budget hearings, there was constant discussion of fiscal cliffs being set up. And I'm just asking you, is Connecticut staring at a fiscal cliff after this, in the next 2 year budget cycle?
For the foreseeable future, I think we're in good shape. We don't need more taxes. We do have a lot more taxpayers. Our revenues, our income tax revenues, capital gains, et cetera, are very strong right now. Obviously, a lot of people had designs on our rainy day fund. We kept our rainy day fund intact. So I think you should feel very confident that we can keep going. Even if there's a recession at some point in the future, we'll be ready.
Mm-hmm. What about criminal justice? I mean, you know, there are Republicans who have been crying for criminal justice reform, especially on the youth side of things. Do you have any proposals to make any changes to that?
Well, let's talk about what we've already done, Christine. Obviously, when I was first elected, we started adding on to our state police force, which had been we had fewer people there 5 years ago than before. So we've added on to that. We've added on to the additional class. We're there to provide state police support for our municipalities. With the $500 million a year that we gave in addition to our municipalities, strongly recommended that community policing be part of those initiatives, start getting more folks on the street. I think you know that we're adding on another class of justices, seeing how fast we can get those judges, because right now the wheels of justice are turning a little slowly. When it comes to somebody that gets picked up, we got to make sure if they're a danger to themselves or a danger to the community, you know, they're in detention for a little bit of time. So those are all things that we have done already. We've given the judges all the information they need to see whether this is a first-time offender who made a mistake or this is a chronic offender we got to deal with separately. So if the legislature has other concrete suggestions that'll make a difference, I'm all ears.
But will you be proposing anything additional? You know, you're going to be presenting the legislative agenda in February. Between now and then, presumably you're going to develop that agenda. Will you be including any criminal justice proposals to build on what you just described?
Well, certainly. We did a lot of work in terms of the wraparound and social services, Paul, and I sort of addressed this obliquely today as well, to make sure a lot of these kids who are under incredible distress over this last year and a half, make sure they stay in the saying true. I'd like to see our continued involvement there. There's ways that we can, I really need the courts to work faster. I think it's slowed down. It's everything from commercial to juvenile, and you know, justice where justice is due. Let's face it, we were all slowed down over this last year and a half, and there was a real backlog. So my real priority is to get that back up to speed.
Governor, a little while ago, you said something about letting teachers, we let our teachers teach, and there was also a reference to this is not some woke thing. So what I want to ask, based on what you saw in Virginia and a little bit in New Jersey, what are your thoughts on the fact that there seems to be an emerging issue, if not a little bit amorphous one, about the issue of parental involvement in the schools versus, as you say, letting our teachers teach? Go ahead.
Those are two sides of the same coin, aren't they? I mean, you need parents involved. We desperately need that. We need the kids coming home. I want the parents to know exactly what is being taught so they can reinforce what we want to do. I want parents more involved in you know, what's going on right here in this building. I believe in parent-teacher. Look, when I went to Guilford, I don't know, a week before the election, and everybody's talking about parental involvement, I was at a barn that was filled with parents who cared deeply about their education and deeply in terms of how they want their teachers to be able to teach going forward. They think they got the best school system in the country there in Guilford in that case. Keep at it.
All right, there you go. Governor Ned Lamont early today taking mostly questions regarding his incentive to be reelected. Some good pointed questions here. A couple of observations I have on that straight ahead. Yeah, that's us, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Now, you heard from the governor there. He said, hey, you know, we have a lot to do here, ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum. Good questions from the reporters there, because there are questions as to, you know, what happens here when this COVID money goes away. Are we still going to actually be in the black or not? But the thing, and this is what I mean when I mentioned before this, folks, mentioned this before, about the divide between Ned Lamont, who is, you know, and I've said this, it's kind of entertaining, is it not, to have a Democratic governor in this state who tells a lot of the big city Democrats in this state, shut up, we're not raising taxes. I mean, it's kind of refreshing when a Democratic governor tells people like Martin Looney and Bob Duff to shut up, ixnay on the taxes. We're not doing that. That's kind of fun. It's actually more entertaining than if a Republican was doing it, because then the Democrats could just say, well, it's a Republican. Well, guess what, Harvey and Mary? It's a guy in your own party telling you to stuff it with the tax increases. How great is that? But again, he can talk about not raising taxes all he wants. He's going to get a pushback on that. And, you know, the governor also said, you heard him say, well, we're going to try on juvenile justice. There need to be people that dealt with more. Well, he kind of sounds like the Republicans there, doesn't he? But again, it's the people in his own caucus. It's the Gary Winfields of the world, the Martin Looney's of the world, the Bob Duff's of the world who say, hey, there's no problem. Relax. It's just those racist Republicans who hate brown people. Come on. So for that reason alone, another 4 years of Ned Lamont, from my point of view, could be pretty interesting. Hey, I kind of like when, you know, he comes off the top rope with the forearm and tells all the big city legislative leaders, shut up with the tax raises, tax increases. It's kind of entertaining. If you are a Democrat, or if you are an independent but you lean to the left, there are a lot of liberals out there, progressives, who don't want to identify with a party, and I can respect that. I know some conservatives that are like that too, saying, hey, I'm a right-leaning voter, but I don't like the Republican Party, don't like what they do on some issues. So, you know, you can be a liberal or a progressive or a conservative or a far-right person and not belong to a party. We can all do that. But if you are on the left, how do you feel about this? Again, this is one of those things that I read and then I say, you can't be serious. Because what happens is a lot of times when the left loses an election, not all the time, but you're seeing this after last Tuesday in Virginia, a week ago tonight, when the left loses an election, it's never because their policy sucks, right? It's never that, well, we just had a bad policy. People didn't like it. It's misogyny. The men locked up their women in the kitchen and didn't let them vote. That's why we lost. You know, you get that. And, of course, racism. Everything is race now. All those racist voters who elected a black woman, a Jamaican Marine veteran, to be lieutenant governor in Virginia, all those racists, the same people who elected a Hispanic gentleman to be attorney general, all the racists. So a lot of times the left will trot out, well, that's racist, it's misogynistic, it's white supremacy. How about maybe your policies are stupid? How about that? How about 50% plus one, that's all you need in an indirect democracy here. 50% plus one said, no, I prefer not that. And here's another example of setting the foundation for screwing up. And I know they're going to say, well, this won't affect the electorate. It's too far out from the elections. The hell it is, because you've got a party running against you who's going to make sure, as Democrats do with Republicans, you're going to have a lot of Republicans making sure that people don't forget this one. How about this? I'm not making this up. I am not making this up. If you don't believe me and you are a left-leaning voter or a left-leaning participant in our wonderful political process, look it up for yourself. This popped up again late last night of something I told you already over the past couple of days. And this is in Newsweek, by the way. Yes, Newsweek still exists. They don't do a print edition anymore. But there is an online edition of Newsweek magazine. Remember the three biggies growing up? Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report. Remember that? Time on the left. Time was a decidedly liberal publication, and they were counterbalanced on the right by U.S. News and World Report. Then Newsweek was kind of in the middle. This is out of Newsweek. I'm not making this up, folks. Listen carefully. Millions of Americans could face even higher energy bills this winter if the Biden administration closes a gas and oil pipeline running through Michigan. That is coming from a group of Midwestern lawmakers. Get that? The Biden bunch already, folks, I'm not making this up, with the forecasts we're already seeing of higher gas continuing, higher crude oil prices, higher prices for natural gas. They want to shut down a pipeline. Line 5 pipeline could be under the threat due to the White House exploring the potential impact of closing it on fuel prices in the region. That's according to Politico, amid a drive to reduce the U.S. dependent on fossil fuels. Did you just hear what I said? The Democrats who got their rear ends handed to them last week on Tuesday, for some reason, when we're going into the coldest part of the year, already with high gas prices and higher prices forecast for oil, heating oil, and natural gas, they want to shut a pipeline down. And they're looking at whether or not it would affect prices. So you see what they're doing here. If it would affect prices, they won't shut it. Because they'll look at each other and say, no, we can't do this. This is a gun in our mouths. But they may come out and say, we've been told, Mr. President, our experts say at the Energy Department, it's not going to affect the prices. So go ahead and shut it to keep the left-wing lunatics happy. That's essentially what they're looking at, folks. The line delivers Canadian crude oil and natural gas from Alberta to Ontario through Wisconsin, the Great Lakes, and Michigan. It's operated since 1953, and it transports 540,000 barrels a day of crude oil from between two Canadian provinces. Canada's a friend of ours, right? Why do we want to shank Canada in the neck? Why do we want to do that? Is that a good idea? I read on. In a letter to the Biden White House dated November 4th, Ohio General Assembly member Bob Latta, a Republican, and 12 other lawmakers urged Mr. Biden to keep the line running, as closing it would only further encourage rising energy bills. Line 5 has come under fire from Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer in recent years. The issue moved up to the White House agenda after Canada's decision to invoke the 1977 Pipeline Transit Treaty a month ago to ensure the line's continued operation. So you see what Canada's doing, kids, here? They're saying, you know what Canada's saying? Eh? How's it going, eh? You know what they're saying? Screw you. We need our oil. What are you doing, you idiots? Lawmakers who urged Mr. Biden not to take action claim the government's move to end the line's operation is part of a move to soothe. Here it is, folks. I'm not making it up. To soothe environmental groups. So the environmental groups, folks, again, I'm not making this up. Check it out. Newsweek.com. Google the article. The environmental groups, they don't care if people can stay warm. They don't. The leftist nut jobs in some of these groups, they don't care. This comes as Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm warned that Americans should expect to pay higher costs to heat their homes this winter as a result of high gas prices caused by COVID-19. Granholm said the president, who attended the climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland last week, is focused on both the immediate term and long-term solutions, including investing in clean energy. You know, Secretary Granholm, with all due respect, ma'am, I have to tell you something. If you were here, I'd tell you to your face, said, Madam Secretary, with all due respect, 80% of Americans don't give a crap about a Glasgow conference. They don't give a you-know-what, a flying you-know-what. Let's make it airborne. We'll throw one up for you. They don't give a flying you-know-what about a Glasgow conference, about a UN conference. They want to heat their homes. They want to heat their businesses. They want to heat their kids' schools. We have a goodly amount of people in Canada who are saying, wait a minute, you're not going to shut down a pipeline that we need. Folks, I got to tell you, if you are a Democrat or if you are on the left side of the aisle, your party is crazy. They are nuts. They are out of their minds going into the winter. And you want to bring a pipeline political discussion front and center? You're nuts. You ate paint chips when you were small. You were dropped on your head as a kid. Well, we again try to get the latest for you on COVID-19, because we're almost 2 years into this. Some officials may say we're already 2 years into it. They say the first cases popped up in the fall and early winter actually right around now 2 years ago, but we're coming up, I guess, on the official 2 years, right around February or March of this COVID thing. Still a lot of news about booster shots, maybe a COVID pill. So joining us once again, one of our go-to people throughout this whole thing, biology professor Dr. Sarah Crawford from Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor Crawford, Paul again here. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, thank you. Well, let's talk about Dr. Crawford before we get into a lot of the specifics here. How are we doing? If you had to summarize where we are now from when we started on this 2 years ago, are we about where you may have expected, a little better, a little worse? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to admit, my crystal ball could never have predicted the way we are progressing in the fight against COVID. I have a very optimistic view. I think the vaccine rollout has gone fairly well. And currently, the vaccine rollout for the younger age group, 5 to 11, seems to be going well. Of course, we don't have, you know, we have to wait a few more weeks to get all the data, but that seems to be encouraging. In addition, we have some new antivirals that are coming on the market, which is a very exciting development, given the fact that there's uncertainty as to how long vaccine immunity might last and whether, you know, there may be other outbreaks coming up in the pipeline in winter. So our arsenal is really becoming pretty strong, and I'm very excited about that.
Dr. Crawford, what about booster shots here? Before, they weren't necessary, and then they're going to be necessary for only older people. And now, I may be mistaken, but I see more news about more people, maybe not in those at-risk initial categories, getting booster shots. And I'm hearing, you know, there could be a fourth or fifth shot coming up. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, that's sort of a big area of uncertainty. We know that people who receive the J&J have very low residual immunity at this point, and they really need to get a booster of either the Pfizer or the Moderna. And even with the Pfizer and the Moderna, we see that the levels of protection are going down over time. We don't really know the whole trajectory. We don't know where this is going. And I think that's what's being watched really closely, because what's keeping this pandemic at bay basically is the vaccines. So we have to make sure they're working. And I think the current push, of course, is to make this booster available to all age groups. And that's really what's being introduced at this point. And at this point, I see there is no harm in that. Most people have done very well with the initial vaccine, and a booster will only make things better in terms of providing protection.
Professor Sarah Crawford is the guest. Professor, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Got to do a little business. We'll get more into the COVID thing, boosters. And when we come back, we'll ask the professor about a pill form now we're seeing from a major drug manufacturer. And they talk about combining that with an AIDS medication. Why would that be necessary? We'll have that answer and info on it straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together, 436 on WICC. All right, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. We'll get back to open phones. And toward the top of the hour, to wrap up the show here, it's a Tuesday edition of Connecticut Today. Tomorrow, we hope to hook up with a Bridgeport union official to talk about the union push for hero pay, for hazard pay during COVID-19. So we'll bring that to you hopefully tomorrow during the show. And right now, more chat about COVID-19 with Professor Sarah Crawford, a biology professor at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. So, Professor Crawford, what is it that we hear now about a pill form of antiviral here? And did I read this right yesterday, that it would be coupled with an HIV drug? What's the deal with that?
Well, you know, I'm very glad you asked that question, because my research as a graduate student at Columbia University involved the use of protease inhibitors. In my lab, I worked with Dr. Stephen Goff, and what we did was we were looking for the genes in viruses, retroviruses like HIV, and what they did. And what I found is my graduate thesis research was that if you target the protease gene, the virus can reproduce itself, but it's not infectious. And that became a protease inhibitor treatment strategy for HIV. And now it's becoming a treatment strategy for COVID. So you block the protease, you block the ability of the virus to make its proteins infectious. So the virus is released, but it's a dead virus. And this is a wonderful therapeutic modality that's now being developed by one of the pharmaceutical companies, which is the Pfizer Paxlovid.
Mm-hmm.
There's another drug being developed by Merck, molnupiravir. That is a replication inhibitor. It doesn't work quite as well, but it's giving 50% results, so we'll see how that goes. But protease inhibitors are huge for antivirals, and we see it now coming to fruition for COVID, which is really exciting.
So can you see, Professor Crawford, maybe a time in the next 2-3 years, whatever, assuming we don't completely get rid of this, would the majority of treatment maybe be simply by pill, or would the intramuscular inoculations also have a permanent place?
Well, I mean, I think you will agree with me when I say both. I mean, I think a vaccine is very, very important. We don't know long-term how well the vaccine will give long-term protection.
Mm-hmm.
So there are true infections. We're seeing that now. So if we have another weapon in our arsenal, if you get a breakthrough infection, we can do that. We can treat that if it's caught early. So I think we are moving on the plus side of all of this. And this is going to be a century event that is going to be remembered 100 years from now and analyzed in so many ways. And I will say one thing.
Sure.
I've been thinking about this. Someday, I hope, we will have a conversation that is more positive than talking about this pandemic. When we can say, oh, remember when we were discussing the pandemic?
Oh, yeah.
Now we can talk about other medical issues. So someday that will happen. I don't know when. My crystal ball is not quite in focus.
Yeah. Mine needs new batteries. I have to go out and get it. Finally, you know, you've probably seen, Professor, the rumbling now, and Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA head, who's a Connecticut resident, he kind of fueled this the other day. You know, at what point, when do we, assuming we're never going to get rid of this completely, and assuming maybe, I may be wrong here, but assuming there's going to be some level of positivity going forward here as far as testing is concerned, when does this end? When is it right around that 2-year mark that a lot of virus specialists say usually is it, or do we have to go another year without breakouts? What are your thoughts on that? When is this over?
Well, my thoughts are, you know, keep in mind that this is a global situation that developed in China at the end of 2019. We knew what was going on. We had these, you know, information that suddenly evolved that this is happening. And it's a global problem, and it's nowhere near solved. And I think until Russia and other parts of the world that are now having a huge resurgence of the infection, until globally we see a calming down of the infectious rate overall, either due to the fact that people are vaccinated or these antivirals are working, or they've already been infected and have protection post-infection, I think we're still going to have to deal with this issue. It doesn't solely reside in what happens here in America. And I think that should make us aware of our global interconnection as a family or global family that fights disease. And I think if we can unite on that front, we're really going to move forward in a very important way in the 21st century.
And as always, we thank you for your insights. Professor Sarah Crawford, Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, thank you, and we'll talk down the road. Take care. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right. There you go. So there's the update. We're getting there. Like she said, we're getting there. It's going to take a while, but we're getting there.